Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
He's been called a true spiritual master, someone who radiates empathy and optimism. As the writer Barbara Brown Taylor once put it, nothing human is foreign to him. Ron Rollheiser is no stranger to Tapestry, although it's been a long time since he was here. The last time was in 2006, and that was a conversation I've never forgotten. Father Ron is now 75. He's been a Catholic priest for most of his life, but his wisdom is worth listening to, whether or not you'd call yourself spiritual. There's a theory you sometimes hear from atheists that believing in God is something you outgrow. Father Ron says that view is fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go nearly far enough.
Sophistication, as Paul Ricoeur, the great philosopher, said, it's a stage you pass through. You don't stay there. No, Paul Ricoeur gave us the wonderful expression, he called it, coming back to second naivete. When we're naive, we believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny. We get sophisticated. We stop believing in that. When you get post-sophisticated, which is we're supposed to be in maturity, you start believing in Santa, the Easter Bunny again in a different way. Your life opens up to mystery again.
In his long career as a philosopher and theologian, the priest from Saskatchewan has become known as one of the most important voices in spirituality today. But Father Ron does most of his writing for people who aren't philosophers or scholars of religion, people who might not even know how to pray.
Mary, the oldest definition, classical definition of prayer, which is still the best, said quite simply, says, prayer is lifting mind and heart to God, which means you lift what is inside of you at that moment to God. And it might be anger, it might be bitterness, it might be praise, it might be gratitude. But see that every feeling, emotion you have is an apt entry into prayer.
Rollheiser says there's some real wisdom in the work of another scholar who argues that the world's major religions really need to lighten up.
She says, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, we all believe in the same God. But she said, tragically, we all conceive of God in the same way, as male, as celibate, and as angry most of the time. And also that God is frowning most of the time. Mm. That's just deeply ingrained in all three religions. We need to purify our notion of God and not make God look like a male celibate who's angry.
Ron Rollheiser returns to Tapestry. I'm Mary Hines. Ron Rollheiser grew up in Cactus Lake, Saskatchewan, on the family farm. He was ordained in 1972, and he's spent many years since then teaching philosophy and theology. Ron Rollheiser has a PhD from the University of Louvain in Belgium. He's a faculty member and former president at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. Ron Rollheiser is my guest. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back. It's been a lot of years.
It's been a lot of years, and I've been hoping you'd come back. I loved our last conversation, and I'm really looking forward to another chat.
So am I. Thanks, Mary.
You know, you've said something really striking about the spiritual path. We are all on it, whether we want to be or not. We all have a spirituality, whether or not we believe, whether or not we belong to any religion. Where do you see someone's spiritual path if that person isn't a believer?
Mary, spirituality or a spiritual path, people identified with an explicit faith or a church, and you can, but everybody has a spiritual life. So that because everybody has spirit, you know, spirit, it doesn't, first of all, mean Holy Spirit. It means your soul, your energies. You know, like, sometimes when we use the word soul, we think we're using it incorrectly. We're using it correctly. We say, like, soul music.
Mm.
It's something that moves you. But everybody has this deep kind of, while the Greeks called it eros, just this powerful energy inside of us. That's our spirit. And what we do with that is our spiritual life. I mean, you can act that out in a church. You can act it out just in society, or your love life, your married life, your professional life, you know, how we act that out is our spiritual life. And everybody has one. It's not something you first of all do in a church.
You've suggested that we are living in a world that is spiritually tone deaf in a lot of ways. Tell me what you mean.
We're tone deaf in many ways. Let me give you an example and I'll use the analogy. For instance, we're ritually tone deaf. We no longer understand how ritual works and what it can do for us. But I think we're spiritually tone deaf in that, in terms that we never connect our energy to spirit. You know, in fact, oftentimes we put it in opposition to spirit.
You've said that being in that state of spiritually tone deaf means the simple act of saying a prayer can become a real challenge for a person. And I find your guidance here really interesting. You've said something along the lines of all of your thoughts and all of your feelings are legit. That's all valid material for prayer. Just lift up whatever's going on inside you at the moment. I mean, what if I feel that whatever's going on inside me at any given moment isn't worthy of God, isn't worthy of being a prayer?
Mary, the oldest definition, classical definition of prayer, which is still the best, said quite simply, says, prayer is lifting mind and heart to God, which means you lift what is inside of you at that moment to God. And it might be anger, it might be bitterness, it might be praise, it might be gratitude. But see that every feeling, emotion you have is an apt entry into prayer. Now, St. Paul has an interesting line. I don't think we've ever really kind of teased it out, where St. Paul says, when I don't know how to pray, then the Spirit, he said, in groans too deep for words, prays through me. So that means, you know, when you're exasperated, and I hope this isn't going to get CBC censored, someone says, you're driving and say, oh my God, and something. Well, that's a prayer. Sometimes the distinction between prayer and profane or swearing language is thinly drawn.
Oh, then I am a saint, Father Ron. Then I'm the holiest woman who's crossed your path in ages.
But you have to identify that with prayer. You know, you have to say that this isn't swearing. This isn't, there can be maliciousness and so on. But a lot of times just our exasperation or like I invite kids to pray their boredom, you know. They go to church and they're bored sick. You know, and their parents say, you're not bored. Of course, they're bored. But pray boredom. Pray your anger.
What would that sound like if I were to pray boredom? What words fit that moment?
Quite simply, go to church and sit down to them. I am just bored, sick, sitting here.
You can say that to God?
Yeah. And I want to say, I don't want to stay here. I'm bored, but I'm going to put this hour in and I'm going to stay here. You know, Thérèse of Lisieux, the famous saint.
The little flower, Saint Therese.
Somebody once asked her, said, is it wrong to fall asleep when you're praying? And she said, not at all. She said, a little child is equally pleasing to her parents, awake or asleep, maybe more asleep. So, in fact, the great mystics, John of the Cross and so on, they say the deeper you go in the spiritual life, the more your prayer is going to be that, you know, where you're there. There isn't a lot to say.
An editor once invited you to write the book he needed, and he proposed the title, Why I Still Believe in God and Why I Still Go to Church. And the result was your book, The Holy Longing. Tell me about that. I mean, I just find that a really interesting set of instructions, you know, that the editor would say, okay, this is why I still believe. This is why I still go to church. How did you shape that into an argument for staying on that path?
The man who was actually a great man called Eric Majors, and so He came to me one day and he said, I want you to write a book on spirituality. And so I wrote the book. That's kind of an apologetic approach, but I think it's a good one. You're not trying to prove religion's right or whatever. You're just saying, like, how can a person today functioning in our world, being reflective, being critical, looking at things, how can you continue to be a Christian? How can you continue to go to church? In my case, even how can you continue to be a Catholic? The book starts to where we started today with Eros. You know, first of all, you know, St. Augustine coined a line 1,700 years ago that'll always haunt the human psyche. And Augustine simply said, you've made us for yourself, Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And, you know, there's no place to find peace on this planet, inside of our psyche, without some movement towards the transcendence. So that's the first part of the book. But then I do a Christian part, like, how can Jesus make sense today? How can the church make sense to, in spite of its scandals? How could we live out the Paschal mystery? What does it mean to live out social justice?
You see something profound in the heart of every human being, and you've said maybe it can only be expressed through old legends and myths. It's the profound idea that before we're born, God or the Creator or whatever word you use, touches our souls, kisses the soul, and then sends us off on this life on earth. And the memory of that tender love stays with us quietly, sometimes buried pretty deep. I know some of this is hard to put into words, but how do you understand that idea?
You know, Bernard Lonergan, the great, was one of the great intellectuals of the last century. And Bernard Lonergan says, you're born, he said, with four deep principles stamped in you. You know, classically, we always said God is one, true, good, and beautiful. And Lonergan says, when a baby is born, those principles are inside of it. You wake up to them, you're not taught them. So, for instance, you don't have to teach a little kid, this is ugly, this is beautiful. They know it. You wake up to it. You don't have to tell somebody, this is true, this is false. They know it. See, so that Lonergan says that he comes at it philosophically. He just says the transcendental properties of God, oneness, truth, beauty, they're stamped inside of us. You're born with them. See, so those energies are inside of us, and they're stamped inside of us, and they're irresistible. So the image I use, which kind of comes from Henry Nouwen, where Henry Nouwen says, he calls that dark memory. Mm. We have this dark memory inside of us that's not conscious. It's just, it's there. Now, the mystics, they cloak that with just this beautiful image. It said, God puts the soul in the body, God kisses the soul, and then seals your memory against it. And incidentally, the Greeks, they believed that's why you have a cleft under your nose. They said, like, God puts the soul in the baby when it's completely formed, and then he seals the baby's memory under your nose. You can't speak. He said, and that's also why every time you're trying to think of something, your finger, you know, just goes under your nose. But that's a mystical image. But the whole idea is what I call dark memory. You have that inside of yourself that's always there. And also you experience that in what sometimes called the deepest part of your soul. That's the part of you where you most want intimacy, but you're also the most protective. You're careful who you let there. That's where you can be violated and so on. And that's today often. Today I like the expression to say, you're searching for your soulmate. When you say, I'm looking for my soulmate, it means I'm looking for somebody to meet me at that place. It takes you home.
Mm. When you were a very young priest, one of your teachers reminded you, there is no recorded incident ever of Jesus having laughed. Do you know when you realized that humor could be part of the journey? That whatever equation taught that the more spiritual you are, the more humorless you must be, that was warped?
Yes. But Mary, I realized that in two ways. You know, I grew up in a very robust family with lots of humor and pranks. And so I guess I always realized that unconsciously. But I grew up in a Catholicism that as a religion had a little bit of a heaviness to it. But it took me to study theologically and do studies and so, before I realized we need to teach this theoretically. Let me say this about Jesus. Jesus shocked people equally both ways. Jesus shocked people by his capacity to give up his life. He shocked people equally with his capacity to simply enjoy life. You know, you have all these incidents in Scripture. The woman at his feet and everybody scandalized, and Jesus is thoroughly enjoying the moment. I'm convinced that Christianity has to begin to preach a Christ who challenges us to enjoy life. You know, who challenges us, as Charles Taylor, your great Canadian philosopher, says, you know, to thrive in life, to God puts us here. God wants us to thrive in life, and God wants us to enjoy our lives, not, you know, in the hedonistic, forget about tomorrow, tonight I need a friend type of thing, but just that we can deeply drink in just the joy of living, of friendship, of wine, of everything.
You are a funny guy. It's there in your sermons. It's there in your writing. And yet you've said the God you grew up with was pretty humorless. How do you encourage people to think of the divine in a way that in a manner that's more joyous, more delighted, and less somber?
Mary, that is a huge, huge task for all the churches and all religions. You know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. She's a wonderful Jewish scripture scholar at Vanderbilt called Amy Jo Leving. She recently spoke at her school, and she's a very colorful woman who, among other things, smokes cigars, which I can appreciate in somebody. But at one point, Amy Jo says this. She says, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims, we all believe in the same God. But she said, tragically, we all conceive of God in the same way, as male, as celibate, and as angry most of the time. And also that God is frowning most of the time. Mm. That's just deeply ingrained in all three religions. And we need to purify our notion of God and not make God look like a male celibate who's angry. You know, that's the God we have, not just in Christianity, but in Judaism and in Islam.
You're with Tapestry. Thanks for inviting us in. Whether it's on podcast or on the CBC Listen app or on CBC Radio 1. If you're listening online at cbc.ca/tapestry, hello to you. I'm Mary Hines. My guest is Ron Rollheiser. Rollheiser grew up in Cactus Lake, Saskatchewan, on the family farm. He has spent many years teaching philosophy and theology, and he has a PhD from the University of Louvain in Belgium. Ron Rollheiser is a faculty member and former president at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. You have faced off against atheism from time to time, and this tendency for some people to think that atheism is a mark of sophistication, it's a mark of maturity, it's what happens when people outgrow childish superstitions. What does that argument miss, that argument that sees atheism as the height of sophistication and human maturity?
I'm going to come at this two ways. First of all, inside of our churches and inside of kind of conservative fear, the whole idea is don't study too much. Don't learn too much. Don't ask hard questions because you're going to lose the faith. Marilynne Robinson, the great novelist, who's actually a wonderful Christian commentator, she says, you know, that's what the Enlightenment, that's the critique they made of Christianity, was, you know, if you grow up, you'll stop believing in Santa, the Easter Bunny, and religion. That's wrong. See, atheism has this thing about if you get sophisticated enough, you know, you're going to outgrow it. That's the theory of the Enlightenment. The issue there is this. Sophistication, as Paul Ricoeur, the great philosopher, said, it's a stage you pass through. You don't stay there. You know, Paul Ricoeur gave us, he coined this wonderful expression, he called it coming back to second naivete. I can put that into a simple image. When we're naive, we believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny. we get sophisticated, we stop believing in that. When you get post-sophisticated, which is we're supposed to be in maturity, you start believing in Santa, the Easter Bunny again in a different way. Your life opens up to mystery again. That I want to give you a wonderful image I got from Michael Mead, the anthropologist. Mm. So Michael Mead says, imagine you have a two-year-old kid. The kid can hardly talk. And the kid says to you, Mom, where does the sun go at night? I said, well, with a two-year-old, don't pull out an atlas and a globe and start seeing the solar system. You say, it's tired. Takes a sleep. You take a sleep, gets up in the morning, you get up in the morning. Now when you're five or when they're six or seven, doesn't work anymore. That's when you pull out the globe and show the solar system. And then when they're 21 and 22, that doesn't work anymore either. Then you bring out Stephen Hawking's and you start talking about, you know, the Big Bang and, you know, universes being formed and black holes and space and astrophysics and so on. And it gets ever more sophisticated. And when you're 75, you say, where does the sun go at night? Takes a sleep behind the barn. Do I have to take a sleep? You know, see, the key in life is to move to a certain post-sophistication, which Jesus called childlikeness as opposed to childishness. We need to outgrow our naivete. We need to become sophisticated. Then we need to outgrow our sophistication. See, true maturity lies on the other side of both. My argument with atheism is it stops and it doesn't reopen itself to mystery.
I want to stay with this idea of post-sophistication and mystery. You've found some real inspiration in a book called When God Was a Bird. And that writer is urging people to see the whole world through a lens of enchantment, and not in a make-believe way, but in a very physical way. Tell me about the idea from When God Was a Bird that perhaps the literal earth can feel joy, can feel pain.
Mark Wallace, and Mark Wallace is a believer, Christian, but he wrote a book called When God Was a Bird. And his thesis is this, and I love the thesis. He said, you know, Christianity and Judaism, from where we came, we've been too afraid of what he called pagan sacraments and pagan realities, so that, you know, it had to have a Christic label, or we were scared of it. This was paganism, that's New Age or whatever. And he said there was a reason for that. He said because Christianity and Judaism, they were the first religions that became monotheistic, so that they were fighting animism, where there were gods and everything, in birds and trees and rocks and so on. But he said now, 2,000 years later, he says, it is time we stop being afraid and we turn back to begin to read God in nature again. You know, that's such a rich thing to say. We don't have to be afraid of nature. We don't have to be afraid of what he called secular sacraments and pagan sacraments. They can be very rich. They can enhance our Christianity. They can enhance our belief.
I've recently interviewed a very thoughtful Irish theologian named Mary Condren, and she's been thinking about what she considers a wrong turn in Christianity. And if I can do justice to her argument, she says that by making everything about blood and sacrifice and the cross, this is a religion that's turning its back on everything that's life-giving and full of light and delight. And she said that's one of the things she admires about St. Bridget, whether you see her as a saint or as a goddess, pre-Christian goddess. Her symbol is the morning dew. Do you think Mary Condren is on to something?
But this, Mary, is a question of emphasis. You know, we can't lose the central reality of the cross inside of Christianity. It's kind of the hermeneutical key that breaks everything else open. But the danger is, as soon as you put overemphasis, it robs this thing we talked about before. Then God hasn't got a sense of humor. God is angry most of the time. We're sinful creatures. I think if we really preach Jesus as a whole, Jesus preached the cross, but he also, as I said before, he preached strongly, are you enjoying your life? So I think it's all a question of balance. And interesting, the two go together. You know, a person who can give his life away can enjoy it, and a person who can't give his life away also can't enjoy it, you know? And so that it's paradoxical. But no, she's right. I think in the past we've had too much emphasis on the cross. We can't turn Jesus into Disneyland either, you know.
This is Tapestry, keeping you company and helping you make sense of the world. If you're listening online at cbc.ca, hello to you. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app, on Spotify, on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, and on CBC Radio 1. We always like to hear from you. Sometimes your suggestions for interviews end up on the air. Write to us, tapestry@cbc.ca, even if just to say, hey. And you can listen to more Tapestry interviews online at cbc.ca/tapestry. Whenever I read a book of yours, I end up with a sticky note on practically every page. There's so much I want to ask you about. And I'm going through my notes for this interview, and at one point you ask, what can God and nature have had in mind when they designed the aging process? And I've scrawled in the margin, yeah, good question. How do you answer that one? What have you come up with on that front? What is aging and the indignities of aging? What are they for?
You know, our school, I've set up an entire program we call Forest Dwelling, where people come, it's 2 years, if they come in cohorts for 2 weeks at a time and so on. And we're looking at that, but let me talk about, you know, what did God and nature have in mind? Nothing is by accident. What is the intent of aging? Now, I'm going to start with a metaphor which is not mine. It comes from James Hillman, who wrote a marvelous book on aging called The Force of Character. But Hillman says, he asked that question, what would God and nature have had in mind? And the answer is this way, he said, a metaphor. He says, the best wines have to be aged in cracked old barrels. And you see, you know, what aging does is it mellows the soul. And the whole book, he lays out how different aspects of aging, how they help mellow the soul. And he says, why does nature design so that when you reach a certain age, you can't sleep through the night, you have to go up and go to the bathroom during the middle of the night? He said, well, it's no accident. He says, if you look at monks, they set their alarm clocks and get up in the middle of the night. Then they're awake for a while, and they call it having vigils. He said, so you get up at night, you have to go to the bathroom. He said, then you can't sleep for a little bit. Then he says, the goddess of night, mythically as the goddess called Nyx, N-Y-X, that she comes around her bed with her children, and her children are called grudges, bitterness, angers. And you have to deal with her because you won't deal with her during the daylight.
Here's what I'm curious about, though, Father Ron. If that's part of the divine plan and we're meant to have bodies that sort of fall apart, but then our souls will shine all the more brightly, you get a certain luster and you get to the essence of the human being. What do you think happens to that plan when an entire culture resists aging so strenuously, whether it's plastic surgery or Botox or lip injections or whatever? If an entire culture has decided that aging is for losers, what happens to the gifts that aging brings?
That's true. And it's sadly, we end up resisting it. And then, I don't know if you're familiar with a man called Richard Rohr.
Oh, yeah, I love him. Richard Rohr.
Yeah. But Richard says, when you get to be, let's say, 70, 75, he said, there are only three options available to you, no matter what culture you're in. He said, you may become a pathetic old fool. That's an old fool, you know, who's trying to be young. Botox, tummy tucks, you know, marry somebody 30 years younger and on, okay? But he said that there's a pathos to that, okay? He said, or you can become a bitter old fool. And he said, a lot of us become bitter old fools, or he said you can become a holy old fool. Mm. But what I like about that, notice what's non-negotiable, you're going to be an old fool. it's only you only get to pick your type. So we know a culture that resists that. So instead of producing holy old fools, we're going to produce bitter old fools, and we're going to produce pathetic old fools. The old fool, that's a non-negotiable. Nature decides on that.
I didn't realize you were 75. You've been a priest for most of your life now. This latest book of yours is part of a series called Modern Spiritual Masters. And There are people I've interviewed, a bunch of them on Tapestry, who look to you as the wisest spiritual guide they lean on. So it was curious to read about how strenuously you fought the call to religious life way back in the day. You did not want to hear that call at first, not one bit. Tell me about that struggle.
See, so for me, there was no attraction to the priesthood. Zero, zero. You know, even though I was a religious young man, but, you know, I wanted to be a psychologist. But, you know, I didn't have a healthy image of the priesthood. I considered priests as naive people. I was 17. Like, who wants that 17 look? I would be celibate for the rest of my life, minister to people. But with me, it was a call that I couldn't stop. You know, I'll give you a line. Remember, if you've ever read C.S. Lewis's autobiography, and he talks about the night when, you know, he converted, like he had been this agnostic, and the first night, the time he ever gave credence to Jesus, he said, notice he said, I knelt down the most reluctant convert in the history of Christendom. Notice he didn't say, I knelt down and say, wow, this is great, you know. He said, the most reluctant convert in the history of Christendom. But then the next line is important. He says, but I did this because I had come to realize that the harshness of God is kinder than the softness of man, and God's compulsion is what liberates us. You know, God's compulsion. Say, well, what's God's compulsion? Quite simply, the way I put this for myself is, we have three faculties. You have a head, a heart, and what we call a gut. So your head tells you what you think it's wise to do. Your heart tells you what you want to do. And something else tells you what you have to do. My head wasn't in it. My heart wasn't in it. But something inside of me said, you need to do this. And you know something? It's marvelous. I don't think I'd have been a success in marriage or whatever. You know, God called me and was able to use my wounds and my deficiencies as strengths, you know. But it's not something I would have ever decided on. But it was a call. And I think that God always, a lot of times, takes you to where you don't want to go, but it's the right place for you.
And how long did you have to trust in that before you felt, oh my God, I'm in the right place? I'm glad I answered that call. This is what I'm meant to be doing. Did you have to just go on blind faith for a long time?
The deal I kind of made with God is I'm going to go to the seminary, and if it becomes unbearable or I have some type of a breakdown, the sign I should leave. Well, it never happened. You know, I thrived in the seminary. I loved the studies. But, you know, when did I make the decision, say, this is where I belong? Later on in ministry, where and also partly I became reflective when I started doing the spiritual direction with other people, where I realized, you know, God has given me a very generative ministry here. I could never do this stuff except here. And also, why would I leave? Because there's such deep meaning in this. You know, I make a distinction between happiness and meaning. You know, if somebody asks you, Mary, are you happy? I don't think it's a good question. That's a question to torture yourself with, you know. Are you happy? Well, maybe not, and so on. But if someone says, is there meaning in your life? That's something different. You know, see, meaning abides. Happiness, the way we define it, is ephemeral. It comes and goes. So at a certain point, I began to realize this is a deeply meaningful life, you know, and that meaning trumps my own need for happiness here or there. In that meaning, I can forgo and give up really important good things, which is like marriage, sex, family, you know. Those are major values. You know, I'm the last person to ever, you know, disparage them. I'm like Thomas Merton. Thomas Merton was once asked, this journalist said, what's celibacy like? He said, it's hell. He said, you live in a loneliness that God himself condemned, you know. It is, but it can be very fruitful. It can be meaningful.
One of the things you're grappling with as a priest is how to reach people in a secular world. What are some of the things you have in mind? How do you even begin when you're not starting from the same frame of reference as a non-believer? How do you walk into that secular world and speak to someone?
A little bit, and I don't pretend to have the answers, you know, because that's the big question. But my go-to thing has always been like the holy longing. You start with human feelings. You start with your longings. You start with your achings. You start with, you know, what am I longing for? Why am I looking for a soulmate and so on? And see, and I think that's universal. It's religious, but it's not explicitly religious. To always start with, you know, what am I searching for in life? What are my restlessness about? You know, what do I need in this life? What's going to bring me some kind of solitude or peace? That's still my starting point.
Ron Rollheiser, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mary.
Ron Rollheiser is a Catholic priest from Saskatchewan. He's a faculty member and former president at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. Rollheiser has written more than a dozen books. His latest is part of the Modern Spiritual Masters series from Orbis Books. It's called Ron Rollheiser, Essential Spiritual Writings. Ron Rollheiser spoke to you from San Antonio. I'm Mary Hines. You may have heard at the beginning of this episode, Ron Rollheiser was last here in 2006, which was pretty much a lifetime ago for many of us. Back then, Father Ron was a healthy guy in his 50s. Today, he marvels at the fact that really good doctors have been helping him stay alive, even though he's had stage 4 cancer for years. Even with the diagnosis, Ron says he is still optimistic, even buying green bananas. Here's a bit of our first tapestry encounter with Ron Rollheiser back in 2006. Can you do it without church, without mosque, without synagogue? Can you do it on your own?
It's a good question. Not easy to answer because let me give you an analogy. If you're sincere, sincerity is always the deep part, you know. If you're sincere, you know, God's going to work with that and so on. But sincerity without guidance can also lead to a lot of dumb mistakes. You know, the same as, let me give you an analogy. It's like physical health. If I say to you, Mary, could you really take care of your body without reading medical texts and seeing, you know, well, you could, but you might not realize that this food is bad for you and this other thing is wrong and your cholesterol's building up and so on. It's the same spiritually. When we go on a quest and we don't, you know, let some of the experts help us, we can just do a lot of silly mistakes and we can have spiritual high cholesterol and not know it. See, so that's the one of the things about, you know, the classics and the scriptures and, you know, the great literature like John of the Cross and great theologians and so on. But then the community is part of a separate issue. The community is needed in religion in the same way as community is needed in life. So that if I am not vitally linked to some kind of family, some kind of friendship, some kind of, you know, or constant interaction, there's a real danger I'm going to be deluding myself. And see what communities do is communities, they're like, they defantasize you. They correct you. You live in a family.
They keep you honest.
Yeah. And they keep you and they make you grow. Mm. Now, they also have one of the side. That's the good part. The bad side is oftentimes families won't let you grow beyond their ceiling either. See, a family won't let you fall through the floor and they won't let you grow through the ceiling. And see, alone, you can grow through the ceiling, but it's more likely you're going to fall through the floor. And the third part about that is inside of Christianity, community isn't a negotiable component. You know, Christianity, by essence, and I try to put that quite strongly in the books, Christianity is something you do with other people. You can be a Buddhist alone. You can be an Islamic person alone. You can worship with other people. You don't have to. Christianity is not like that. See, Christianity, the whole idea is we're part of one body, and we're being called as a community to come to God, not as come as individuals.
I would like to explore your definition of spirituality. I saw this in one of your books, something vital and non-negotiable lying at the heart of our lives. That makes it sound so palpable. How do you counsel people who would love to feel something vital and non-negotiable at the heart of their lives, but it just ain't so. It just doesn't feel like it's there.
Well, one of two things is happening then. Excuse me. Either if they're genuinely not feeling it, then there's something not right there. See, normally, unless I'm in a clinical depression or on the edges of clinical depression, or I'm just so deeply wounded and so on that I have to protect myself from my own feeling, your soul, your heart, you know, they're going to be generating feelings, you know. See, it's more likely they're out of touch with those feelings, or it's more likely they're denying the feelings, or more likely they can't get the right names to those feelings. See, so that oftentimes I find the struggle with spirituality is not that people don't have the spiritual feelings. They cannot take their religious language that they've been given and in any way connect that to what's going on in their real life. So that's a vocabulary problem.
Hmm.
You know, there's a wonderful writer, United States, Kathleen Norris, who's maybe my favorite author. And but see, Kathleen Norris, remember the subtitle of her book, Amazing Grace, she says, the search for vocabulary for the faith. See, we have words for the faith. We got the scriptures. We got all 2,000 years of words. Oftentimes, we don't have the words. I mean, we've got the words. We don't have the vocabulary. Today, I'm convinced in the church, the biggest problem, we don't have a vocabulary for today's society. Some of the writing I want to do is precisely, and it's hard. Like Henri Nouwen, one of the reasons I liked Henri Nouwen was consciously, deliberately searching for a vocabulary, you know, a way of creating a language of soul that honors and is true to our traditions, and at the same time, it doesn't just repeat the language, you know. So simply put, if I say to somebody, Jesus died for your sins, that's true. I don't think 99.9% of people have any idea what that means. And they couldn't explain it if they were paid $1 million for it. You know, they have some sense of what it means, but we don't have words for that. Now, the words are true. Jesus died for our sins. Jesus paid the price for my sins. Or in evangelical theology, we're washed clean in his blood. Well, what really does that mean? If someone, how are you washed clean in Jesus' blood? So you got the teenager, you got the person who's just working through his divorce and hasn't been to church for 10 years and might be angry at the church, and he or she is having deep religious experiences, but they cannot connect any religious language or symbol and stuff to those experiences. So oftentimes they won't feel those experiences properly, or they'll simply deny them or blunt them out by simply never thinking about them. So I go home at night and I'll drink 2 glasses of scotch and watch Jerry Seinfeld, and you go to bed, you'll sleep pretty well. You don't have to think about those feelings. And part of the reason why we don't have the words, we don't have the symbols. And I think today in the West, the first world, that is the biggest religious task. We've got to get a vocabulary, and that's what I'm trying to do with my books. And I mean, it's a struggle. It's a lifelong struggle.
There is, on this topic, there's a beautiful quote of Teilhard de Chardin. I think it's in The Holy Longing, you're quoting him, you know, just being genuinely perplexed. Why is it that so many good people find themselves quite agnostic, quite incapable of belief in God? And Teilhard's response was, well, they just, it's something to the effect of, they just haven't met God in the right way, or God that hasn't been explained to them in the right way. So what would be the right way to present God to someone who's struggling with the whole notion?
You know, that's the right question, but right now we're looking for the answer. You know, see, if I had that answer, but it's also an answer that we have to create and build by doing it. So, for instance, I look at Henri Nouwen, who I think was, I can't speak for other languages, but in English, I think he's the most important spiritual writer in popular spirituality in the last 50 or 60 years, you know?
Come on, you just said Kathleen Norris.
Well, no, she's going to, I'm putting her next generation, you know? See, but Nouwen was very, very consciously trying to do that. And to a certain extent, he did it. You know, that explains his popularity. And then you have like Kathleen Norris trying to do very much the same thing. And see, Kathleen Norris was a gifted writer, a gifted secular writer who has immersed herself into the Desert Fathers tradition, the deep old...
The cloister walk.
Yeah. And then can take those insights and then run them through the filter of a good writer who tries to put vocabulary. But what both Henri Nouwen would tell you, or at least did tell me, and Kathleen Norris would be, and it's a struggle. I mean, the language still has to be created. It's not like it's out there and you pick it up at Costco and you find, you know, a software package and here's the language for. It has to be made. See, the stories that you need to tell your children, they don't exist until they happen to you, you know?
There's a more distressing answer to this question in some of your writing, and I feel like I've been going around quoting this essay of yours, A Shrinking Horizon, in which you explore that it is, in fact, a great struggle to believe in God for a lot of people. And I think it's great to see a priest acknowledge that it can be a struggle and understanding this. I'd like to hear a little bit more about this. What is it about the times in which we live that can stack the decks against belief in God?
A number of things. You know, I used to have a professor in Belgium, wonderful, old Dominican guy, and he used to say contemporary life constitutes a virtual conspiracy against interiority. That's kind of interesting. But it's an unconscious conspiracy. It's not like there's forces out there conspiring to bring down values or so on. It's the pace of life, the speed of life, to quote Nouwen, the agnosticism of ordinary consciousness.
So that's the default position in these times?
Yeah. Huh. Let me put that in the way I put it in the essay there, sociologically. See, sociologists talk about, a cognitive majority or a cognitive minority. So, for instance, I grew up in an immigrant community in which everybody went to church, God was center and so on. You would have had to be a deviant not to believe or a deviant not to go to church. Today, I look at my nephews and nieces, it's the opposite. I grew up, it was a cognitive majority, you know. The culture carried the faith, it carried the church. Today, the culture doesn't carry the church, doesn't carry the faith. And so there's a lot of, I love this expression from Robert Coles, the psychiatrist or psychologist at Harvard. He calls it, there's a powerful moral loneliness in our culture. That you're really alone in the deep things, you know, and you live in a moral diaspora. You know that.
That's great.
You know, and see, that's why words like soulmate take on such powerful meaning. You're looking for somebody who's going to really share your soul. Mm. You know, we have all this companionship and all this social and activity and so on, but in the deep parts, you're alone. And see, that's where faith is. So there isn't a lot of support for the faith. Karl Rahner once said, "You're either going to be a mystic or you'll be an unbeliever." Again, it's sincere. People are good. I love those people, and they're fun to be around. There's a shrinking horizon there. And then we create the God of the gaps. We're going to turn to God those times when tragedy, sickness, and helplessness forces us to be deep, you know, because we can't be shallow all the time.
Because you can't live on the surface forever.
You know, a friend dies, you get cancer or whatever, you become deep real quick. You become real deep, you know. But then it's unfortunate. We don't have practice. We don't have the language. We don't have the concepts to enter our own depth then.
So can you meet your God in those one hopes scarce moments of tragedy, or is that just a recipe for disaster?
No. All meeting is better than no meeting. It's, you know, again, to use an analogy, if you have kids and they never come home, but they come home when they're sick or something, well, it's better than not coming home at all. I mean, those oftentimes can be grace moments. They can be grace moments, and oftentimes they are, where they say, you know, Mom, I got to come home more. You know, I didn't realize that I loved you and everything else. See, sickness forced them home, and oftentimes it opens up the channel. Now, the danger is they're going to go back to their life, and as soon as they get healthy, they're going to forget about you again. And God can handle that. I mean, God is not a petty little tyrant who's upset because we're not thinking about God every minute. You know, God is the ultimate lover with great patience, and God waits for God's chances. So, no, those moments, I wouldn't be cynical about them at all. They are precious, and they're better than nothing.
I keep going back to this essay because I think there's so much there. You talk at one point about our collective incapacity to believe in God, and I'm struck by this word, collective. You know, you see this as being something larger than any one person's struggle to believe or not to believe.
Yeah, I mean, see, we do understand that. We're beginning to understand that psychologically. So, you know, the whole question of dysfunctional families and you know, our the wounds we carry from our childhood. See, collectively, today it's becoming, we're creating a collectivity that makes it very, very difficult sometimes not so much to believe in God, but to act on that belief and to make it something vital and real in our lives. And, you know, I've had lots of time. I could go into lots of prongs. That's not abstract. A lot of stuff can be named. So, for instance, for me, one of the biggest prongs inside of that in Western culture, and it's philosophical, and that is the powerful individuality and, in some sense, pathological individuality we live in the West, you know. And you see that in symptoms, for instance, young kids who don't want to get married. Just say, well, it's nobody's business, and we live together and so on. See, that isn't just a Christian fault. That there's a human, you know, there's something human missing there because we're part of a community, you know. No people in history ever had that even luxury to say that, you know, we need each other. Today, we don't think we need each other.
Do you think that's because the individual has run amok, the idea of the individual?
Yeah, absolutely. Huh? The idea of the individual has run amok. Part of it is very good. Like in the West now, we have the highest freedom, individuality, chance for individual development that's ever happened in history. Mm-hmm. And that has to be affirmed and blessed. It's not a bad thing, you know. But we haven't caught up yet on the collective side. So in this country, we have a charter of individual rights. We don't have a charter of community rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so, see, we're one-sided, and we're paying a price in loneliness and family breakdown and parish breakdown and religious breakdown and every kind of breakdown.
Yeah, I want to pick up on this idea of the mystery because you write very powerfully about the ancient instinct for astonishment and that we've lost it.
Yeah.
Is that a lost cause? Is that gone and not coming back, our ability to be astonished, our ability to give in to a mystery, to not know the answers?
No, it's lost right now on everything but children. Children do it, little kids do it, and so on. It'll make a comeback. You know, if you look at the big swath of history, you know, and even in literature, you've got romantic movements and you have the rationalists and so on. There'll be a reaction to our rational, you know, our excessive rationalism, and you're already seeing it partly in postmodernism. In postmodernity, there is a reaction to just excessive rationalism, to say, like, you know, what about mystery? What about mysticism? What about ritual? What about the things we can't understand? Because we're adult children of the Enlightenment, the same as you can be an adult child of an alcoholic, you know, and which means there are no surprises. Everything can be analyzed. Everything can be explained. Everything can be somehow technicized. And
what have we lost?
Depth. See, when you lose mystery, there's more depth. You can never be surprised. There is nothing new under the sun except new inventions, you know, which, you know, are just upgrades of old inventions, you know. Like, do you go ever a day where you think, you know, today I might be genuinely surprised. I might meet something that just changes my life, or there's a whole new depth of life I've never understood before. No, we've already got life psyched out. And we know its limits, and that also limits the depth we can go to. And then the odd time again, like, my hope is in, see, the God is God of surprises, the same as like I talked before. There'll be tragic experiences that push us into depth. God also lays traps for us, and every once in a while, we are surprised. And something happens, and all of a sudden, we're restored again. That's one of the reasons why Jesus said, you got to be like a little child. See, little children, new things happen to them. To you and I, new things don't happen.
I feel like I have to move to Texas just so I can go to your church.
I don't have a church, I have a school.
I'll go to your school. Father Ron, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. This has been delightful, actually.
That was Ron Rollheiser in a Tapestry interview from 2006, produced by Susan Mahoney and Marika Mayer, with technical production by Dave Field. That's it for us this week. This episode was produced by Arman Egbali and Samir Chabra. Technical production by Laura Antonelli. The senior producer is Rosie Fernandez. I'm Mary Hines. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.